quiet problem for the CIA, the assistant deputy director who one day disappeared in Europe. He'd fantasized about living in luxury in Russia, watching American satellite TV shows about his own disappearance and presumed death. He'd been looking forward to it since Mr. Black reached out to him months earlier. But it wasn't going to happen now. That was obvious. The CIA knew he was the one they'd been looking for. The murder of Deputy Director Renfro had not caused the heat to be turned down on Wheeler, and now the only thing he could do would be to overtly run to the other side, get spirited out of the potential clutches of the Americans, and be whisked off to Russia, where he'd always have to watch his back, worrying about the CIA knowing exactly where to go to settle an old score. He'd still have the money he made selling secrets to the Chinese, the Iranians, and the enigmatic Englishman who seemed to be laser-focused on protecting the interests of a group of Russian oligarchs, as well as a long-dead general whose name had popped up in a CIA printout just days ago who had seemed to precipitate this entire affair. He hadn't a clue what a dead general named Zakharov had to do with all this shit, and he wondered if he'd ever know. Wheeler first decided to sell secrets to the highest bidder, just days after he was moved out of operations and into support, and then bypassed for the deputy director position there. Matt Hanley, the new deputy director of operations, had been his friend and his superior officer in 5th Special Forces Group. They'd served together in Grenada in Panama in the Gulf. Wheeler appealed to Hanley to intervene to save him from the move into support, because even though it was a promotion, leaving operations would be a career ender for a guy like Wheeler. He was an ops man, always would be, and support was no place for ops men. But Hanley refused to intervene. The director wanted the move, and Hanley was playing ball to curry favor for his own reasons. Immediately, however, Wheeler found out more about those reasons. It became clear in just weeks that Hanley was setting up his own off-book operations, all with the director's tacit blessing. Wheeler was constantly getting calls from Hanley asking for aircraft, safe houses, offshore dummy corps, and the like, always with a wink and a nod to check out with the director if he had any doubts. It seemed clear enough early on to the new assistant deputy director of support that Hanley had moved Wheeler over to support to have his own inside man there who could make things happen without any red tape. Wheeler did as his old friend and superior asked, but inside he fumed. Meanwhile, his asshole boss, the former congressional staffer and lazy prick Lucas Renfro, treated him less like a second-in-command and more like a petty underling. Wheeler thought seriously about the private sector, but every time he got the feeling it was time to leave the agency, his anger at what he saw as his mistreatment by his superiors left him with a desire for vengeance. He knew things. He knew a lot of things. And the one place he knew he could pass information to others with little fear of being caught was in the Sub Rosa realm. Matt Hanley, like his predecessor, was going full tilt now on secret ops. Wheeler didn't know the details of the programs themselves, but as a support executive, he was privy to transportation needs, safe house security, and other elements of these off-book initiatives, and passing this intel off to parties who would pay handsomely for it had seemed like a good idea at the time. His first sale was to Chinese intelligence, letting them know that a CIA aircraft would be landing in Hong Kong as part of a code word operation. The Chi-Coms paid handsomely for this, so Wheeler then sold info to Iran as well. After a potential deal with Russian intelligence fell through, Mr. Black appeared from nowhere, told Wheeler everything he wanted and how much he would pay for it, and Wheeler obliged. And now he was racing for his freedom through London, hoping like hell he could make it into the Peruvian embassy, from where he'd be snuck out, delivered to some out-of-the-way airport, and flown to Russia, or Peru, or, at this point, just anywhere where no agency in the Five Eyes could lay hands on him. It was all such a fucking mess. He looked up from his shaking hands as they turned onto Sloane Street. He checked the map himself on the plane the night before, and he knew the Peruvian embassy was just up ahead on the left. He tried to look out the front windshield to see it, but instead he saw an oncoming gray four-door, its driver's side door open, veer out of its lane and into the lane right in front of the racing van. The Russian driver stomped on his brakes, but the sedan slammed grill first into the van at speed, sending the van's driver forward, his head pounding the steering wheel and rendering him unconscious. The front seat passenger had not been belted in, and his face hit the windshield, squirting blood from his nose across the inside of the glass. In the back of the van, Wheeler was thrown forward, but his restraints sent him banging back into his headrest, simultaneously both saving and dazing him. But the remaining two Russians were unscathed. Seat belts were unfastened, guns came out of jackets, the sliding door was opened, and the first man leapt out onto the two-lane street in a cloud of smoke and steam from the damaged engines of both vehicles. While one of the Bratva men trained his weapon on the gray vehicle that was crumpled into the front of the van, the second man reached back in, unfastened Marty Wheeler's seatbelt, and pulled him out by the collar. Zach Hightower climbed to his hands and knees just 25 yards up the road from where the crash happened. He'd taken a shortcut through a parking lot to get there first and floored it, then angled his Kia at the approaching van. He opened his door and rolled out onto the street, banging virtually his entire body into the asphalt as his momentum carried him forward. He was still rolling forward as his vehicle scored a direct hit with the oncoming van 25 yards away. But rolling along the street had been no big win for Zach Hightower. His knees and elbows and back screamed in pain, and it took him longer than he would have liked to recover enough to stand upright, pull the Smith & Wesson out from the retention holster under his torn blazer, and raise it towards the car crash. Brewer had instructed him to meet force with equal force, and he intended to do that, more or less. But Zach had no interest in a fair fight, so when he saw the first man step out of the steam, his pistol leveled at the car Zach had just exited, the American went lethal, firing twice into the man before he even looked up the street. A woman standing on the sidewalk near Zach screamed, and this sent his gun spinning in her direction, but only until he saw she was no threat, and then his attention, along with his pistol's barrel, shifted back to the wreck. He advanced on it, weapon high, and then he saw two men close together moving out from the smoke and steam. He recognized Marty Wheeler and took the other man for an armed extraction asset, so he shifted aim off a CIA man and onto the unknown individual. A pistol jutted from the man's hand, and for Zach that was more than enough justification to go weapons free. He shot the man twice, once winging him on the left side of the head and once in his upper chest, knocking him back from Wheeler just a few steps, but somehow the man did not drop. The gunman raised his weapon towards Zach, who fired again and again, finally spinning him down to the pavement with a half-dozen .40-caliber rounds in him. And then Marty Wheeler began to sprint off. "Shit," Zach said, because he fucking hated to run. Chapter 47. Suzanne Brewer had last heard from Romantic 3 minutes earlier, telling her he was going to attempt to cut off Wheeler's access to the Peruvian embassy on Sloane Street. She didn't know exactly what he meant by this, but she drove along Knightsbridge Road, planning on seeing her asset holding Wheeler and the others at gunpoint, and she thought about driving up on that crazy scene right here in the heart of London. Brewer asked herself what the hell she was doing here. She was not a field asset, and the only reason she'd told Romantic she would come to his aid was that she knew he would tell Hanley if she didn't come. She didn't know what she could do to help. She was unarmed and only knew her way because she'd punched Romantic's location into Google Maps while she drove. But here she was, barreling into danger in a blacker-than-black operation that would do nothing to advance her career, even if she somehow managed to save the fucking queen in the process. Her phone rang and she answered it, expecting it to be her asset, but instead, it was Matt Hanley.
"I'm at the embassy, meeting with conference security officials, giving them vague and useless information about a new threat we've identified. Can't tell them about Mars because of their leak, and I need you here to..."
Brewer interrupted.
"Sir, the mole is Wheeler. He's been picked up by some kind of security crew here in London, and they seem to be making their way towards the Peruvian embassy in Knightsbridge. Romantic is in pursuit with orders to stop the vehicle by any means necessary, and I am going to the location to assist."
Hanley did not reply.
"Sir, did you..."
"I've known Marty Wheeler since the army. 30 fucking years, Suzanne."
"The evidence is pretty clear, Matt. Romantic says Wheeler ran an SDR before switching vehicles, loading up with some fighting-age Slavic-looking men."
"Not Marty."
Matt, the asset is seconds away from attempting a stop on the vehicle.
After another delay, Hanley said,
Damn it. Okay, all right. If Zack gets him, tell him not to bring him here to the embassy.
Sir?
We need to interrogate him outside the official chain of custody. I'll call you back with an address, somewhere out of the way.
Brewer closed her eyes a moment in deep irritation. Matt, you can't interrogate a senior executive of the CIA off book.
Who the hell says I can't? Certainly not the director. He'd want me to get this sorted out as quickly and as quietly as possible.
Brewer just said, Yes, sir. Told him she would be standing by for the location of the safe house, and then disconnected the call. After she did this, she screamed in the car,
Shit!
She hated the position she'd been put in working for Hanley, and told herself that once she plugged the leak named Marty Wheeler, she would begin putting all her efforts into finding a way out of this morass before she ended up dead or in prison. Hightower ran in his western roper boots, finally catching up to Wheeler as he tried to cross Knightsbridge Road, but was forced to stop because the traffic was too heavy. The big blonde American with the beard and sideburns reached out and grabbed the thin white-haired man by the neck, then pulled him along the sidewalk. Zack sucked in a few breaths before speaking, then said,
Not a big fan of running, Martin. Gotta be honest with you.
He kept his hand on his prisoner's neck, tight and back, pushing him onward quickly now. Wheeler himself was wheezing from the 45-second sprint.
What? What do you want? To shoot you in the motherfucking heart for making me chase your ass, but I'd probably just get in trouble. So instead, you and I are going to go to the embassy. The U.S. one, not the Peruvian one.
I don't know what you're talking.
Save it for someone who wants to hear your whiny spiel about how this is all some kind of an honest mix-up. I'm not in the mood, asshole.
Police cars raced by, paying no attention to the two men on the sidewalk. Zack's earpiece beeped, and he answered it. A minute later, Brewer picked them both up in her Ford Taurus. Zack shoved Wheeler into the back. Climbing in next to him, he resumed his rough hold on the back of the man's neck. Wheeler said,
Suzanne, you know I didn't...
Zack elbowed Wheeler hard in the mouth, then leaned forward to talk to Brewer.
To the embassy?
She started driving off, and she shook her head.
I just spoke with Hanley. We are taking him to Wimbledon.
For tennis? Zack asked. What the fuck?
No, not for tennis. It's the name of a neighborhood to the southwest of London.
Why are we going there?
We are to deliver ADD Wheeler to an agency black site we have established in a warehouse.
Wheeler snorted.
Come on, Suzanne. Who do you think you are dealing with here? I'm a support exec. I know all the black sites, and we sure as hell don't have one in London.
We didn't until we snatched you, Mr. Assistant Deputy Director. But Hanley knows a place, and says it will work fine for his purposes.
Zack smiled now and looked at Wheeler, who was clearly uneased by what Brewer had just told him.
You hear that, Mr. Assistant Deputy Director?
Sure you did.
And you know exactly what that means. You aren't getting the above-board treatment,
nope. You're about to go down the rabbit hole.
From this moment on, anything can happen to you, and nobody will know. Unless and until Hanley decides to put you in the system.
Wheeler looked at Zack, then made a pained expression. Zack smiled at the man's discomfort, but he quickly realized what was happening. He grabbed the man's head and turned it forward, just as Marty Wheeler vomited, covering himself with bile and partially digested coffee and croissant from his in-flight breakfast. Suzanne Brewer looked back at the scene and shook her head. She just could not understand how her career, her life, had fallen so fucking far, so fucking fast. For the first several hours after her father left her in Belyakov's mansion, Zoya Zakharova waited under relaxed guard. She was given ample food and drink, but told nothing. Not until Fox entered and informed her that the helicopter that was going to take her to her destination would be arriving shortly. Eventually, it landed, and Zoya was walked to the large black aircraft, surrounded by Fox, the big blonde-haired man she had heard referred to as Hines, and a pair of Russian security men with high-quality gear and weapons. No one told her where they were going, but she could see the setting sun to her left, so she realized the Hilo was heading north. They flew into a gray evening, the clouds forming around them. Soon she could see nothing of the terrain below.
After several hours, the Hilo slowed and descended under the clouds. She tried to calculate how long they were in the air, and she thought back to her knowledge of the map of the United Kingdom. They must have gone all the way up to Scotland. Of this, she was relatively certain. But since she'd seen little in the way of mountains or even severely hilly terrain before landing, she doubted they could have gone north of Edinburgh or Glasgow, both in Scotland's southern third. No one had laid a hand on her, nor had she attempted to resist at all. There were a couple of times she thought she might be able to make a break for it, right before they boarded the Hilo and right when they climbed out. But both times she realized someone would just catch up to her, and, anyway, she knew that being close to her father and his operation was the best play for her right now. She wasn't worried about being killed, but she was very worried about whatever scheme her dad was working on, so she decided to stick around to see what she could learn. The helipad was adjacent to a two-story industrial building. From the looks of it, Zoya imagined it had something to do with the oil and gas industry, and as she walked through the rainy night behind Fox and in front of Hines, she saw a sign above the building that said, "Edinburgh Pipeline Supplies Limited." Soon she was shepherded into a car, and they headed off. Just when Zoya was about to ask where they were going, a question she knew would not be answered, Fox leaned over to her. "Sorry, Miss Zakharova, but I can't let you see our destination." And with that, he put a blindfold over her eyes. "I'm not going to tie you up, but don't take it off, or Big John here will get annoyed with you." She could feel Fox lean closer, and his breath was in her ear now. "You don't want that. I would love to watch it, but your father would be mad at me, so let's all just behave." She sighed, sat back, and crossed her arms in front of her. Zoya suspected it was nearly midnight when they entered a city. This she could tell by the sounds and light that filtered through her mask, and the increasing number of starts and stops on the steeply graded roads. Soon, they slowed, made a 90-degree turn, and began heading down a decline. From the echoes and even more bright light than before filtering through the mask, it registered in her brain that they had entered an underground parking garage, obviously somewhere in Edinburgh. When the vehicle came to a stop, her blindfold was removed, and she was led out of the back seat. She indeed did find herself in a garage, and she followed the entourage through a door and up several flights of stairs. Almost immediately, she could tell she was in some sort of medical facility or research laboratory. She was led down a cavernous hall past a few open doors, and then Fox asked her to enter the last room on the right. She did so, immediately saw the little cot and the bottles of water and the blankets, and realized this was to be her quarters. She turned around to face the Russian. "You're locking me in here?"
"Yes, but I'll have food brought to you. It's no ensuite, I'm afraid. This is a converted office, but there is a bathroom just back up the hall. Knock on your door and one of my men will escort you."
"Where is my father?"
"He will be arriving in the morning. Until then, let me know if there's anything I can do to make you more comfortable."
She looked up at the British man named John Hines, who always shadowed Fox, the man who had beaten court so badly some 24 hours earlier. The man smiled at her.
"How's your friend feeling?"
Zoya replied, "Never better. You know, if I'd had one more bullet in my gun last night, you'd be dead."
The giant just grinned at her.
"If I'd had 3 more bleeding seconds last night, I'd have snapped both your skinny necks."
Zoya looked to Fox now.
"How tough are you when he isn't by your side?"
To this, Fox laughed.
"I would not know. He's always by my side."
Fox and Hines turned and left the room. The door clicked shut, and then Zoya heard a lock being engaged. She sat down in the windowless room that, she couldn't help but notice, was set up much the same way as her room at the CIA safe house back in Virginia. There was significance to this, she decided, something to do with the fact that both sides saw her as both a potential asset and a potential threat. But she was too tired to think it over right now. Instead, she lay back on the hard little cot and closed her eyes. The door opened once when a Russian mob goon wearing a scowl delivered her a bowl of stew and a bottle of white wine. She ate every bite of the stew and drank all the wine, and soon the same man came to retrieve it. Zoya looked around the room a moment and saw the camera that had shown him she was finished. This group of Russian mafia men seemed to run their holding cell just like the CIA did. Soon, she just lay back down on her cot and wondered if Court was doing any better than she was right now. Chapter 48. Marty Wheeler had been lashed to a chair in an empty white room. His shirt and pants had been removed, and the bearded man with sideburns who had captured him squatted against the wall in front of him, giving him constant stink eye when he wasn't picking at his badly scraped elbow. Marty was hungry. Marty was cold. Marty was tired, but he was hopeful as well. Hopeful, the British voice over the phone, the man who had paid him for his intelligence product, was right now working on some sort of plan to get him out of this mess. But hope faltered as he thought it through. He'd already given him the information about Turnhill, the information about Poison Apple and Matt Hanley and Lucas Renfro. The Englishman didn't really need Wheeler any longer, and this pierced his heart like a dagger. As an asset, Barnacle was spent. No one would be coming for him, and he knew it now. The man with the sideburns took a call. He talked quietly for a few moments, said, "Yes, sir," a half dozen times, and once glanced malevolently towards Wheeler. Soon, the door opened behind Wheeler. He didn't even try to look back over his shoulder to see who it was, because his bindings were too tight to turn his head more than a few inches. He heard the voice of his old friend Matt Hanley, but it didn't relax him now. No, it terrified him.
"Romantic, I need you to give me some time with the guest."
"Yes, sir." The big man stood and passed by Hanley as he stepped around in front of Wheeler, and soon the bound man heard the door clicking shut behind him. Wheeler thought Hanley would take the chair, but instead he stood just feet in front of his old comrade and friend.
"Why, Marty? Why the fuck?"
"It's all a mistake, Matt. You know me. You know I..."
"Don't embarrass yourself. We got all we need on you."
Wheeler deflated slowly, then said,
"Wish I had an exciting story for you. But it's just the same old tired thing, I guess. Passed over for a promotion. Pissed off and vengeful. Ready to burn some shit down and get paid for it on my way out."
He made another effort to shrug, gave off a hint of a smile.
"Nothing you and me both haven't heard 100 times.
Hanley's thick neck reddened.
"I guess now you're going to beat a confession out of me, or get that junkyard dog of yours who's been following me for days to do it."
Hanley shook his head.
"A confession? No, not necessary. I want to know what Zakharov is planning, though. Any chance he could fill me in on his endgame?"
"Zakharov?"
Wheeler was confused. "The dead GRU chief? What are you talking about?"
"You didn't know Zakharov was the one who paid you for the intelligence on Dirk Visser?"
Wheeler said nothing.
"He goes by an alias. Maybe that would help. David Mars."
The bound man shook his head.
"Don't know him."
"Englishman, or appears to be anyway."
Wheeler cocked his head now.
"You said he was the GRU general. How is he English?"
"Zakharov is a trained linguist. He's also a murderer, and you helped him."
Marty looked at the floor a long time, then said,
"Okay, okay. I knew my contact as Mr. Black, but that's all I know. Never met him. Didn't know he was Russian."
He looked around the room.
"I want to speak to whoever is in charge here."
"Save it, Marty. It won't help you."
With more fear in his voice, Wheeler said,
"I don't know anything. I just don't."
"Then what the fuck do I need you around for?"
Marty Wheeler realized what Hanley was saying.
"Wait, I do know things. My extraction. I was supposed to hook up with the Solnetsevskaya Bratva here in London, get a ride to the Peruvian embassy, and hang out there until I was shipped off to the port to take a freighter to Russia."
"But none of that happened, so that's pretty fucking irrelevant, isn't it?"
Wheeler looked down. Hanley said,
"You know something, Barney."
He shook his head.
"I don't know shit. He didn't involve me,"
Hanley interrupted.
I'm not talking about Zakharov. I'm talking about what you know about the agency.
What? What do you mean?
You've seen some faces a guy like you isn't supposed to see. You know some things a guy with morals like yours shouldn't be allowed to know. You aren't making a case for why I should keep you around.
The bound man looked uncomprehendingly at the DDO. Because you'll go to prison if you make it to where I'm not around. Jesus, Matt. Power has gone to your head.
You got a lot of good men dead, Marty. And you standing trial. That would be a mess for the nation.
Wheeler thought he understood. With a crack in his voice, he said, You're going to get your asset to kill me, Matt? Is that it?
Of course not.
Wheeler breathed a sigh of relief.
I'm going to do it myself.
Hanley drew a Glock 23 pistol from inside his coat, held it up.
Standard issue. Nothing fancy.
A gun a guy like you might happen to get hold of somehow.
We're friends, Matt.
Which makes it harder. No question. But it also makes me more pissed off at you. So, in some sense, I guess it will make it easier. I'd let you know after, but...
Suicide? You actually think anyone will believe I shot myself? Hanley shrugged.
Your people staged Renfro's body. I saw right through it. I think I've got the skills to make it look like it was death by your own hand. Let's find out.
You're fucking crazy, Matt. You're worse than the last guy in your position. All your off-book shooters blasting their way across the First World. Washington, London, Paris, Hong Kong. It's fucking nuts, man.
Matt knelt down next to Wheeler. I don't do a damn thing the director doesn't let me do.
Tell that shit to someone else. I was ops before I was support. You remember, don't you? The director doesn't have a clue what you're up to. He just told you he didn't want to know. So you've taken that as carte blanche to do whatever the fuck you want to do.
Hanley moved closer to Wheeler now, his face inches from the seated and bound man. Well, I gotta tell you, Marty, I know that's not true, because I do a whole lot of shit I don't want to do.
He lifted the gun in his left hand.
But this, I very much want to do.
Hanley shoved the barrel of the gun up under Wheeler's chin. Fuck you! Wheeler shouted. The gun went click, and Wheeler screamed falsetto. Slowly, Hanley stood back up and holstered his weapon. Tears filled Wheeler's eyes now, but through them he was able to see his old friend look at someone or something behind Wheeler's chair. Addressing the person who was obviously now standing there, Hanley spoke slowly, emphatically.
To within an inch of his life. You copy?
The bearded asset who'd been squatting in front of Wheeler minutes before responded, demonstrating that he had not, in fact, left the room.
Solid copy, sir.
Deputy Director of Operations Matt Hanley walked past the Assistant Deputy Director of Support without another word or glance, and then the asset appeared. He'd put on a pair of contractor gloves, and he turned to face the man strapped to the chair.
Matt! God, Matt, no! Please, no!
Hanley shut the door on the way out, but this did little to drown out the screams. Zoya Zakharova awoke with the loud click of the lock being disengaged from the heavy wooden door to her cell. She rubbed her eyes, and they cleared to reveal her father standing in the doorway. She sat up while he grabbed a chair and walked over to her with it. Behind him, he left the door open. She could see no one out in the hall. It was a show, she was certain, a means to convey to her that she was not a prisoner here, although she didn't believe that for an instant.
My darling Zoyushka, how are they treating you?
Don't call me that. Zakharov frowned.
I understand why you're angry. I have taken your liberty, just like your friends in America did.
He looked around the little room.
Was it much like this over there?
It was better. He acted like he didn't hear her.
I imagine it was very much like this. And then they would have subjected you to the daily debriefings. They took away your clocks. They came at all hours at first to confuse you, to catch you off guard, to destroy your daily rhythm. And then, when you gave them the things they wanted and needed, they gave you more little prizes. What was it you wanted from them? Some exercise? You are looking very fit. Yes, I'm sure they let you work out to your heart's content. Some information, certainly. You asked to see the file on my death, and they rewarded you by showing it to you. Zoya said nothing. It's the standard playbook. All intelligence agencies do it.
Now, Zoya said, do they? Please, Papa, tell me more about what it's like to work for an intelligence agency, because your dumb daughter would have no idea about any of that.
Zakharov smiled. Zoya thought she saw a flash of pride on his face, but he hid it well with his words. Of course you do. I am just emphasizing the fact that you were played by the Americans.
Then why am I here? No one sent me. If they had, do you think they would have left me alone to be kidnapped by you?
You were not alone. Your friend who assisted you two nights ago. The one they tell me John beat into a bloody pulp. Are you telling me he wasn't sent along with you to find me?
That's exactly what I'm telling you. He was over here pursuing something that happened to a CIA jet in the UK. I don't know the specifics, but I'm sure you do. His investigation led him to Terry Cassidy's office. I was there at the same time.
And he just spontaneously decided to save you and then team up with some stranger?
Zoya bit her lip, then glanced away. He and I, we know one another.
Zakharov eyed his daughter. Well, that is interesting. My little girl is in a relationship with a CIA officer.
He's not a CIA officer, and we are not in a relationship.
Zakharov leaned back in his chair. Zoya, we were a family of chameleons. You, me, even Fyo, though his real love was the sciences. But your mother, she was the best.
Zoya nodded. Yes, she was.
We could change ourselves, adapt to different places, languages, cultures. Fit into different legends. We could make ourselves what we needed to be in order to help the Rodina. But ideas, beliefs, I never changed these. Fyo and your mother never switched sides. So, help me understand what happened to you.
Zoya responded with, what are you doing here? I've put together on my own that you are working with both the Kremlin and the Solnitsevskaya Bratva. You've been conducting targeted killings, mostly to support the aims of Russian oligarchs, Siloviki. Uncle Vladi is helping you with money because the Kremlin has anointed him a billionaire, and they would have only done this for operational purposes. So what is it all about?
It's about supporting my country.
Interesting. I thought it was about revenge.
He smiled now. Tell me about Poison Apple.
Zoya's brow furrowed. I don't know what you're talking about.
Zakharov regarded his daughter for a long time. Either you have learned to completely mask your micro-expressions, or you are telling me the truth. I find it curious you don't know the name of the CIA program you are part of, darling. If you really don't know, then your new masters are keeping something from you. What else might they be keeping?
How do you know about this?
Zakharov said, I am an intelligence officer. I have a mole in the CIA.
Not high enough to tell you about me.
The bearded man raised an eyebrow. Touché. But that doesn't help your case. It only tells me you are a prized possession of the enemy.
Zoya looked down at the floor. Finally, she said, what else could I have done but what I did? I just needed to get away from SVR. The Americans grabbed me in Thailand and brought me back to the States. I wasn't a prisoner. After the debriefs, they told me I could come and go as I pleased. But if I chose to stay, they had work for me. Combating terrorists, proliferation, things of that nature. Not against Russia. I told them I'd stay with them as long as I agreed on the missions, and they told me they were fine with that.
That is impossibly naive, daughter.
No, it's not. There is another asset there who has the same relationship.
Then he is Poison Apple as well.
Zoya shrugged. She had never heard the code name. It was either work with the U.S. or head back to Europe where sooner or later SVR would find me and assassinate me. I know exactly what happens to disgraced operatives. I wouldn't have a chance. Zakharov stood, dragged his chair a little closer, and sat back down. He put his hand on her knee, and she did not pull away.
But now you are back among family, my darling.
Lucky me. My only family is a father who kills people.
You are a daughter who kills people.
Not innocence. I don't know what you're doing here in Scotland, but I'm no fool. You are preparing something, some retribution for Mom and Fio, and for what you see as my betrayal.
Zakharov put his hands on his own knees now. You always were perceptive.
You have gone mad, she said softly.
Zoya, darling, many great men were called mad in their time. But on such individuals of singularity and conviction, the world turns.
She looked away again, and Zakharov stood.
I have work to do, but someday soon we will talk again.
What are you doing in Scotland? She asked again. He ignored the question.
Part of me wants to make you disappear. Can you even imagine the shame I will feel the moment I report your reemergence? It is a black cloud on my otherwise perfect record as a patriot of my nation.
Then why don't you just let me go?
Zakharov shook his head. You will be escorted back to Russia, delivered to your leaders at SVR. They will figure out what to do with you. I will speak to some people, old friends to whom I don't like owing favors, but I will make certain they do not end your life. You are still my daughter, even though you have disgraced me.
Fox was standing just out of view in the hall next to the open door when Zakharov stepped out and closed it behind him, then locked it. He began walking away, and Fox trailed him.
Fox, contact SVR in London. Tell them we will deliver Zoya to them. I want you and Hines to do it personally.
Yes, sir, but I'm sure they'd be happy to come get her.
Do it yourself. Stress to them that if anything happens to her, either here or in Moscow, there will be consequences for them.
The elevator door at the far end of the hall opened, and Janice Wan appeared in her lab coat. She stepped out and waited for Mars to come closer, then said,
It is complete. The bacteria is fully weaponized, combined with the aerosol, and placed in the four canisters that will be loaded onto the aircraft.
Very well, Mars said, but she clearly noted a distracted look on his face.
When will the weapon be delivered to the staging area?
I'll take it up to the Highlands right now.
He looked to Fox, who just nodded and pulled out his phone, ready to order men to transfer the biological weapon into the trunk of the Mercedes waiting downstairs.
Are you ready to come with me? I want you to oversee the loading of the goods on the aircraft before we get you out of the area.
I need 2 or 3 more hours here to remove any trace of activity from the building.
Mars nodded.
Very well. I'll leave you a half dozen men for security, with orders to bring you up to the Highlands the moment you're finished.
Wan said now,
I am finished with my 2 lab assistants. They won't be able to help me further, so if you had some sort of a plan for them?
Her voice trailed off, and Mars glanced again at Fox, who was still on the phone to one of the Bratva men somewhere in the building. He just looked up to Hines and gave him a quick nod, and the big Englishman turned and began heading for the elevator to take him down to the first floor laboratory where the technicians worked, far away from the weaponization lab on the 3rd floor. He'd break the 2 women's necks, and he wouldn't even remove his suit coat to do it. Mars started for the elevator to catch it along with Hines, but when he moved, Janice Wan was able to see down to the end of the hall. 2 men sat in chairs outside a closed door.
What's going on? Why are there guards at that door? Who is being kept in there?
Mars sighed.
My daughter, actually.
Wan screeched her reply.
The CIA agent?
Mars entered the opening elevator, then turned and faced her.
Don't worry about her. She knows nothing, and she will be leaving us shortly.
As the doors closed, Mars thought about Zoya and wondered if he was condemning her by sending her back to Moscow. He hoped not, but his utter conviction to his cause determined his decision. He realized now that even though this would not be the outcome he wanted for her, he possessed sufficient conviction to potentially, anyhow, send his daughter to her death.
and it filled him with a sudden and unexpected feeling of strength. Chapter 49. The lunch crowd was full of tourists at the Ensign Ewart, a pub in a 17th-century building just 100 yards or so from the front gates of Edinburgh Castle. The street out front was even more packed than the pub, so when an average man of average height with average hair and a short beard stepped through the door, not a single person looked his way. He continued on to the back, followed a sign through a narrow door, and entered the men's room. Once he was out of view of others in the privacy of the locked bathroom, Court Gentry reached out to the wall to steady himself before moving slowly to the urinal. He'd been popping over-the-counter pain pills since the previous morning, but he still felt like he'd been put in an industrial dryer that had been left on overnight. He hurt like hell, and the past 20 minutes of uphill walking had done his battered body no great favor. The Ensign Ewart billed itself as the highest pub in Edinburgh, as it was perched on the tallest hill in the city. Court did not know this until he heard a waitress mentioning it to a table as he passed, and had he known beforehand, he would have gone elsewhere. He'd picked his central location off the map, figuring it would be as good a place as any for him to stage himself while waiting for more intel from Brewer about just where he was going in the city. But as he left the cheap hotel where he'd spent the morning hours, Court quickly began to regret his decision. There weren't many European cities Court had never operated in during his career, both with CIA and as a private operator. But this was his first visit to Edinburgh, and when he looked at a map on the drive up the evening before, he'd neglected to consider that his map was not topographical. Edinburgh was a city in the hills, however, so the trek had included multiple staircases, a steep climb up a cobblestone street, and a lot more effort than he'd wanted to put in just to find a place to wait for a phone call. He had acquired a motorcycle late the evening before, but it was 10 minutes' walk from him, a walk that required climbing over 100 steps in a narrow alleyway, called a close here in Scotland. Court made it to the urinal and unzipped his fly. Even this hurt his ribs to accomplish, and he wondered what possible good he could do if he had to go into some defended location and rescue Zoya today. As he pissed, he thought about the day to come, and both hoped for and feared the nugget of intelligence that would lead him on into action. He also fought the urge to look down for as long as he could, but eventually this challenge became too great for him. His gaze lowered into the bowl of the urinal. He closed his eyes tight. Fuck. A day and a half after he'd had the shit kicked out of him by the huge boxer, and he was still pissing blood. His earpiece vibrated, and he touched it, not even bothering to stop pissing. "What's up?" he said in a tired voice.
"Violator."
He could tell Brewer couldn't tell if it was him. He replied in a bored tone.
"Ident to follow. Whiskey Oscar Tango Lima Mike."
"Okay, it's you. Are you operational?"
She wasn't asking him if he was feeling all right. She was asking if he could do his job.
"I'm just peachy," he replied,
glancing down again at the pinkish urine. Brewer's voice filled his left ear now.
"We've got a facial recog analysis hit up there in Edinburgh. I've had a team looking at security and traffic cams for the past 8 hours. We finally found who we're looking for."
"Zoya?"
"Artyom Primakov, a.k.a. Roger Fox."
"The made man for the Russian mob that Belyakov mentioned?"
"That's right. He was picked up on a camera near the University of Edinburgh, riding in a black passenger van that turned into an underground garage below a building that used to house a science lab. I have an address."
She added,
"He was not alone."
"How many with him?"
Court asked as he zipped up his fly and sat back against the sink.
"It was hard to tell inside the van from the images. We think there were a total of 5, 2 in the front and 3 in the back."
"Was Zoya in the car?"
Brewer paused.
"Was Zoya with him?"
"Anthem was there, yes, along with a man who looked like he had to have been at least 6'6".
"Bigger, much bigger,"
Court mumbled.
"He came up on facial recog, too, because of a stint he did in prison for murder. His name is John Hines. He's English. You know him?"
"Only socially,"
Court then asked.
"What about Zoya's father?"
We aren't sure what he looks like, but there was no one of his age in that vehicle. We ran a wide search of cameras around that location, and we just snagged a hit from about an hour ago. A large Mercedes pulled into the same garage. A man in the back of the vehicle might have been General Zakharov.
Might have been.
This man wore a beard, but he seemed to be the right age and general build. No photo of Zakharov has been taken in 15 years, so we can't be certain.
What do you think? Court asked.
I think we can assume it's him.
Are they all still in the building?
We are monitoring all the cams in the area and believe so, but there is only one way to know for sure.
I'm gonna take a guess. You need me to just bebop in there and find out.
Brewer sighed. Court knew the woman hated him, but he couldn't help being a smartass to her considering her constant superior attitude.
She said, Look, the British have a mole too, so the fewer who know what we're doing, the better. But I am able to offer you some help if you can wait. We are en route to Inverness right now, and will fly right over Edinburgh. We can stop off there, get to you, and help hit the science lab.
Court laughed.
Oh, great. You and Matt Hanley are going to come in with guns up and save the day?
No, Violator, that's not what I'm proposing. Matt has Jenner's ground branch team working as his security, and they are on board the aircraft. 8 operators. The best. If you can wait 2 hours, we'll drop off Jenner's boys, and you all can make entry on the building.
Court said, The enemy gets a vote, Brewer. If I think they're about to leave, I'm going to have to go in there whether or not Jenner and his pipe hitters show up in time.
I understand. There is another Singleton asset who just arrived in Edinburgh, along with a case officer. I sent them up last night to help in the hunt for Zakharov. I can send them to you.
The CO, is he a shooter?
He heard her typing for a moment.
Well, of course he's been through the farm, but that's about it.
The farm was the CIA's officer training program at Camp Peary. A former Ground Branch Special Activities Division paramilitary officer like Gentry considered the firearms instruction at the farm to be just step 1 of 100 to becoming proficient in shooting and close-quarters battle tactics. But Court knew he was nowhere near 100% himself.
I'll take the asset, and I'll take the CO as a driver. Just in case we've got to move in before Jenner gets here.
He next asked, What are my orders specifically?
Your orders are to kill Fyodor Zakharov.
The possibility that he himself would be tasked with killing Zoya's father had somehow not occurred to him. He'd been looking for a missing prisoner who'd turned up dead, and then his mission morphed into trying to save Zoya. Now he was being sent to kill her dad. It put a lump in his throat. But he said,
Understood.
Violator,
Brewer added,
I need you to understand something. Zakharov is the primary objective. Killing or capturing Primakov is the secondary objective.
When she said nothing else, Court said,
But?
But nothing. There is no tertiary objective.
Meaning?
Meaning Anthem is not, I repeat, not mission critical. Accomplish your primary and secondary and then get the hell out of there.
A lump in his throat was replaced by anger welling deep within him.
Anthem is an asset, same as me. My life isn't more important.
Brewer hesitated a long moment. Court wondered if she was trying to calculate whether the life of either of her assets was important to her.
How grateful is she going to be if you kill her father and then try to save her?
It's not about gratitude.
My point is, we don't know if she is in league with General Zakharov. Making contact with her might just put your mission in jeopardy. You need to consider her a hostile until you learn otherwise. And I don't know how you are possibly going to learn otherwise while hitting that building alone.
He didn't argue the point, because it would just waste time. Instead, he said,
I don't even know what this guy looks like.
I'm sending you 3 images. One is Primakov, another is a photograph of General Zakharov, back when he was the GRU head. The third is the image taken of the man in the Mercedes who I think could be Zakharov.
Court replied,
Get me the images, the address to their location, and the IDEN codes on the 2 who will be joining me.
You don't need IDEN codes. You will recognize both of the men coming to assist you.
She gave him the address, he typed it into his GPS, and saw that it would take less than 10 minutes on his motorcycle, once he got down the hill to retrieve it, to get there.
"Roger, I'm en route," Court said,
and then he hung up. He was ready to continue on with his mission. His mission, not Brewer's, because despite his clear orders from her, there was no way he was going into that building without making every effort to leave with Zoya. Seconds later, Court was out of the men's room, faking a normal walk and a placid face so as not to draw any attention to himself from the dozens of patrons in the pub. On his way out the door, he stopped and looked to the bar. It was midday, and he was operational, carrying a firearm in a capital city in the United Kingdom. Under most any circumstances, he wouldn't consider drinking now. But he needed to be able to move, and he told himself the good effects of the alcohol would, in this instance anyway, outweigh the bad. He ordered a double scotch. The bartender reached for a menu containing the descriptions of the dozen they had to offer, and he started to mention his favorites, but Court just said, "Dude, I don't give a shit. Something strong, wet, and cheap." The bartender raised an eyebrow, reached down into the well in front of him, and drew out a bottle. He poured a double into a glass, took the pound notes, and turned away before Court shot the entire contents in two gulps. It tasted to Court like singed horsehair, and the bartender apparently was aware it was awful because Court caught him grinning. The American put the glass down with a nod, then headed for the door. Chapter 50. 30 men arrived in Scotland in 3 black Zodiac boats that had been disgorged from a freighter in the North Sea. They'd landed on an uplands coastline at 3:10 a.m., exactly on schedule, and then they carried all their gear, 140 pounds of kit to a man, across a barren landscape, moving slowly but surely, boots sinking into the blanket bogs and thighs straining with the climbs up and down rolling hills. By 10 a.m., they had been hiking nearly 7 hours and had not seen one other human being during all that time. Their route had been carefully chosen to keep them away from meddlesome locals, so by the time they neared their rally point, they knew they'd infiltrated the United Kingdom undetected. They were all Russian, with hard faces and tattoos and body armor on their chests and backs, poorly concealed under oversized raincoats. There were rifles hidden in their oversized packs, Kalashnikovs mostly, though some other weapons were represented. These men worked for David Mars now, but they bore little resemblance to the other armed men Mars had utilized here in the UK. No, those had been mafia shooters and hired security, dangerous and skilled enough, but they weren't cut from the same cloth as the formidable new arrivals at all. At the rally point, they climbed into a pair of 16-passenger vans, with all but the driver's seat removed, and sat in the back on their gear for the 2-hour drive to their destination. They left the highway for a road, left the road for a gravel track, and left the track for a muddy field with a few other tread marks directing the way. Here they ascended a hill and parked at the stone fence around a cemetery in front of a formidable-looking stone church. A high-end executive helicopter caught the men's eyes in a nearby field, but there were, at first, no signs of life around. David Mars himself stood in the doorway to the old Gothic church on the far side of the cemetery. He'd only just arrived from Edinburgh via Hilo, and he watched the men as they climbed out of the vehicles, moving silently through the gray, wet afternoon, hefting impossibly large rucks, and then heading up in his direction. All 30 entered the sanctuary and began placing equipment in the few old pews lying around the shuttered house of worship, taking off their coats and adjusting the equipment on their bodies. Mars just looked on while a Bratva foot soldier, part of his protection detail, stepped to one of the men as he unslung his rifle and propped it against the wall. The Bratva man said,
"Nice rifle. Who are you guys with?"
The big gunman in the body armor did not look his way.
"Fuck off."
The mafia gunman sniffed and turned away. Mars heard him mumbling,
"Fucking Spitznaz. Think they're such hot shit."
The 30 men who arrived at the dilapidated church were not, in fact, Spetsnaz, Russian Special Forces, but they all had been. These were former GRU military Spetsnaz, as opposed to foreign or domestic intelligence special forces. They worked for the same organization that General Fyodor Zakharov once ran, but they had no clue they were working for him now. Mars surveyed many of the former special forces men as they assembled, but soon they dispersed. Some moved to the higher church windows or out in the terrain around the castle, performing 360-degree security for the others while they readied equipment and prepared their living space. Mars had definite reservations about using former Russian military in his attack, but his reverence for the skills of these men outweighed his misgivings. This event could not in any way lead back to the Kremlin, but the UK was full of Russians, and more specifically, Russian mafia. So Mars had decided that infiltrating non-mafia mercenaries with advanced training would be an acceptable risk, especially if he ensured that the hiring of these troops was done carefully. First, even though they were mercenaries, Mars knew these men would not leave a fallen comrade behind. There would be no evidence of Russian little green men operating in Scotland on the day of the attack. And second, he'd had Terry Cassidy set up a shell corporation, and one of Belyakov's bankers in Cyprus set up a numbered account that was attached to the firm. The lawyer, following Mars' instructions, left a few misleading breadcrumbs in the paperwork of the shell corporation, should it ever fall under scrutiny. A company that had been sanctioned for doing business in the past in North Korea was tangentially linked to the shell via joint holdings in the shipping industry, and this allowed Mars to breathe a little easier. His highly skilled mercs weren't just here to bolster his attack on the conference, an attack that was initially designed as a feint while the real danger fell from above. They were here to bolster the false flag operation that would keep Zakharov's precious Rodina safe from retribution when American and British spies started dropping dead from lung conditions all around the world at the same time. Some men took positions outside, around the church. A few of them moved out into the cemetery and found a place to hide themselves in tall grasses around the tombstones there. They set up their weapons to defend the location. A sniper climbed the bell turret and broke out a section of stained glass window so he could see the approach from the little road. Mars's real force was here now. He knew they'd all been taking a specific regimen of antibiotics for days, rendering them virtually immune to the Yersinia pestis they would deliver into the belly of the meeting of Western intelligence officials. They'd continue taking the cephalexin during and after the operation as well. With these men here and in place, Mars began thinking of the next stage. Janice Wan was still needed, but not for her scientific expertise. No. She had one more night to live. Only in death would she truly serve her final purpose. Zach Hightower had spent much of the morning in the back of a U.S. Army UH-60 helicopter that was being flown up to Inverness, Scotland, to assist with security for the Five Eyes conference. With him was the young, red-bearded case officer named Jason, who looked nervously out the open door of the helo for much of the flight, while Zach, in contrast, lay on the hard deck and slept with his head on his backpack. The UH-60 wasn't taking the two CIA men all the way to the Scottish Highlands. Instead, it was to drop them in Edinburgh before getting back in the air and again heading north. Brewer wanted Romantic there in case Gentry found himself in need of support while tracking Zakharov and Primakov, and she wanted the case officer loaned out to her to work to establish the safe house and assist the assets with driving and anything else they needed. The helo dropped the two of them off just behind a secluded farmhouse run by the CIA, then departed while the two Americans approached the building. It was a ranch-style property with a large, detached garage and an empty barn. Before going inside, Zach checked the garage and found two black Range Rovers waiting there. They were dusty, but appeared to be well-maintained. Inside, the safe house was simple but expansive, with a large living area and five bedrooms off a hall towards the back. Zach had only been in the house for 20 minutes when Brewer called him.
"We have an in-extremis situation there in Edinburgh, and they need your help."
"Where and what?"
Violator is outside a building on Lauriston Place in the city proper. I need you there to assist in case he needs to make entry. Take Jason with you to drive. Violator might be able to wait on a team from Ground Branch, but if he suspects the occupants are planning on moving, his orders are to penetrate the building and capture Zakharov.
Who the hell is Zakharov?
Brewer realized Hightower knew nothing about what was going on in the UK. She filled him in quickly, telling him that the entire Five Eyes conference seemed to be imperiled by this former GRU general and his scheme. She ended with,
"Hurry, because if you don't get there in the next few minutes, Violator might have to make entry on the opposition location without any backup."
"No sweat. I've saved his ass before. I can do it again."
Zack went into a back bedroom and opened a safe in the closet there, using a code Jason gave him. From it, he pulled a suppressed HK VP9 pistol with a silencer and a collapsed stock SIG MPX submachine gun. Ammunition had been preloaded, so he took a fistful of magazines for the subgun and two extra for the pistol and headed for the garage of the safe house. Jason grabbed a Glock 17 and an extra magazine, and Zack warned him not to point it at anything he didn't intend to destroy. As Jason slipped it into his waistband, he said,
"I've been through the farm. Big fucking deal, kiddo. Watch your trigger and muzzle discipline, or I'll shoot you myself."
Jason said nothing. When Jason launched one of the Range Rovers out of the dusty garage at speed, Zack, in the front passenger seat, connected again to Brewer, who was now flying over northern England.
"I'm moving," he said. "I have one unsuppressed submachine gun and one suppressed pistol. Jason has a sidearm. I sure as hell hope Sierra 6 has his own weapon, because I ain't sharing."
Brewer said, "It's Violator we're talking about. He's always got a weapon. Jenner's team is still 70 mics out. You can get there in 25. Your job is to support Violator and capture or kill the primary target personality. But if Violator goes off mission in any respect, you need to bypass him by any means necessary and get the job done."
Zack held on to the dashboard as the SUV bounced over the rough terrain.
"And I take it you suspect that is a possibility?"
"There is a prisoner there, Zakharov's daughter. Violator might try to recover her at the expense of the operation."
"Here we go again," Zack groaned.
This wouldn't be the first time he and Court Gentry had operated at cross purposes. Chapter 51. Court sat on a rooftop, 5 feet back from the edge, and rubbed his eyes. He wasn't sleepy, really. He'd gotten a few hours on the train ride up from London the evening before. No, his eyes were blurry because he'd drunk another scotch on his way to Lauriston Place, pulling his motorbike over outside the pub and not even bothering to lock it up, because he was in and out of the establishment with a drink in him in well under a minute. He could tell the alcohol was having some effect on his overall pain level. Things still hurt, most things on his body still hurt, but he was able to move around more freely now, which had been his aim. He looked out over the street towards the target location now. It seemed like the 10th building he'd had to conduct overwatch on in the past 72 hours, but he was too hazy to count them all. The location appeared abandoned, just a 4-story brick structure with shuttered windows and no hint of light or movement behind them. He found this odd, here on the edge of the campus of the University of Edinburgh. Classes were out for the summer mostly, but there were still quite a few students and tourists around. And the street below Court was a bustling thoroughfare, all but gridlocked with double-decker buses, taxis, and private vehicles. It wasn't even 1 p.m., so Court worried he might have to hit this location during daylight with civilians potentially in the line of fire. Whatever the hell was going on in there, he hoped it at least continued till nightfall. Brewer called and told him the assets en route were 20 minutes out. He told her to notify them to park in a lot a quarter mile down the hill, just at the base of a long outdoor staircase that ran down a narrow close. He then instructed her to tell the driver to stay with the vehicle and vector the asset to his position. Two men entering the large, quiet building across the street would be suboptimal, Court told himself. So he still hoped the Ground Branch team en route had time to make it into the area before he had to act. No sooner did he think this, however, than he saw a Mercedes roll out of the garage under the building. Looking through his binoculars quickly, he registered a pair of wide-chested, tough-looking men in the front seat, and in the back seat was an older bearded man in a suit. Court recognized him as the man who might or might not have been Zoya's father. Either way, he was Court's target. Court had a motorcycle. He could get down to street level and catch the black Mercedes in traffic. But he didn't move from his hide. Filled with indecision, he just glanced back and forth between the building and the luxury sedan as it moved slowly in bumper-to-bumper traffic. Zoya was not in that vehicle. Of this he was certain. This meant she was likely still inside the building across the street. The decision should have been a hard one for him to make. But in the end, it wasn't. He would not be leaving. His mission, right now anyway, was Zoya. Brewer's orders be damned. But it also occurred to him that with the departure of some of the players from the scene, he had no way of knowing if others inside would be leaving soon as well. He didn't want to run the risk of seeing Zoya rolling out of there in the back of a truck full of Russian gangsters. He decided to enter the building and find her. There was a mantra his principal trainer at CIA, a man he only knew as Maurice, used to drill into him time and again.
Finesse, not force.
Court was a master at both, but he didn't imagine the odds would be in his favor if he kicked in the front door of that building across the street with guns blazing. Finesse was his only shot at this. Normally he would have contacted Brewer, but he realized there was nothing she could do for him now but complain about his decision to let Zakharov escape. No, recovering Zoya wasn't one of his assigned tasks, so the last thing he wanted to do right now was update Brewer on his plan to bail on the mission to attempt to achieve a non-mission critical objective. She would disallow it, he told himself, and he would do it anyhow. So, why trouble her with a phone call? Court would go it alone. He'd been going it alone for a long time, after all. Minutes later, he stood at street level alongside the Target building, just steps away from the down ramp to the underground garage. Brewer had tried to call him, but he hadn't answered, so she'd texted him that his backup was 10 minutes out. He thought about waiting, but he didn't know who she would be sending, and didn't know what she had told the other asset about Zoya. The last thing he wanted was some asshole coming in here and breaking up his rescue mission because it didn't look anything like what Brewer told him his job was. He took the ramp down to the parking garage. Finesse, not force, he reminded himself. At the bottom of the garage was a barricade to prevent cars from entering, but Court simply stepped around it and moved deeper under the building. He found a door to a stairwell, picked it in seconds, then slipped inside silently. Almost immediately, he detected a presence one floor above him on the stairs, a shuffling of footsteps. He drew his 9mm and screwed on the Gemtech silencer, then began moving slowly upwards. Zoya Zakharova knew she was being sent back to Russia the second her door opened and she saw the men. Fox was there, as was Hines, but they had been joined by 4 tattooed, rough-looking, square-jawed types armed with HK MP5K short-barreled folded stock submachine guns. She had not been tied or blindfolded, but there was still no way for her to escape at present.